This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. North Carolina's crime rate has hit a 33-year low, but it's still been a rough summer so far in Durham. Just since mid-May, there have been 7 gun murders in the city, including a 13-year-old girl killed in a drive-by shooting. For decades, the main response to gun violence has been top-down. Lawmakers and activists coming together to reduce the number of guns through new laws or educational outreach, gun buyback programs, things like that. Well, that's how the Religious Coalition for a Nonviolent Durham began in 1992, with a push for stricter gun laws. But it has evolved over the years into something much more bottom-up. Now it holds vigils for murder victims and helps convicted criminals re-enter their communities when they leave prison. The coalition and its executive director, Marcia Owen, have come to believe that nothing is more powerful in the fight against violence than just being there, being present in the community, and being with the people most affected by the violence. I am a member of one of the coalition's reconciliation and reentry teams, so I have seen the coalition's work firsthand. I should say that Marcia and I have worked together. I am a close personal friend, and I have come to respect and appreciate the work she does, so y'all need to know that before this conversation begins. And with that, I'm very pleased to welcome Marcia Owen to the program. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thanks. Good to be your friend.
Tell us about these vigils. What are the vigils? How do they work? What happens?
Vigils are a response to homicides in our community, and they work by people calling us now, since we've been doing this for 14 years, and also for me calling the family of the victim, the homicide victim, and going back to the place of sorrow and tragedy. About 65% of the homicides in Durham occur outside, on streets, parking lots, front yards, backyards, places where children see it is one of my greatest concerns. And so we have a response. One of the things that my faith has given me is an overwhelming voice that says, I'm calling for a response. And so that response is to go to that site, a public witness to the goodness and the peace of our community, that in response to the greatest injustice, which is murder, that there is, in fact, that God is present with us, and that to reach out to the families and friends and children and classmates and congregants. I mean, the ripples just are endless.
And who does? Who attends the vigil?
All the families, friends, and people of faith and goodness. People with no faith, but lots of goodness. Just community members.
And what happens at the vigil?
At the vigil, it's very open. There is no script. That's part of its power, I think, is that there is no script. There's no institution. There's no money. There's no prestige. It's just us with God and one another. And what we do is gather, take time to gather and allow everyone to get there. And then we do invite, there's about 40 ministers, including Rabbi and Iman, in our community who volunteer to lead that. And I think that that's very important. I'm not a minister and possess none of those skills. And there is there's a place for professionals. Right. and so the minister will begin it by expressing condolences. And usually we'll read a poem or a scripture or a song. And then reflect on that briefly. It's very casual. We're standing outside. Traffic can be whizzing by. And then reflect on that, on what he or she would like to offer us. And then we open it up to the family to tell us about who we've lost. Because many of the folks there, the community members, had not had the pleasure and the honor to meet person who was killed. And so that occurs, and that is the most glorious thing I've ever experienced, is to learn about what it means to be a person. You listen to what the families and friends say, and it's never, it's always about how much they were loved by them and how, it's really quite astounding. And then there's an opportunity, and so we just listen, and in that unity.
And this listening and this sense of bringing communities together around this place,
yes,
is what you said is a response. You were called to respond. But initially, that wasn't your response to gun violence. When the coalition formed in 1992, you had a far different response. What was it?
Well, it was to change the laws. And it was as genuine and as deeply felt as what I feel today. I'd been away from Durham for a little over a decade and came home and read the paper every day, like a Herald Sun, and was finding report after report after report of young, primarily African-American young men being killed, shot and killed in my little community. And having lived in New York City and D.C., it seemed like a very little community.
But originally from Durham. So
you
went to Hillside, you then went away and came back and found that it was a different place in that
That's
way.
That's right. Yeah. And so having, experienced Durham as a child and as a teen and a young adult, I knew that all the what people attribute to that, oh, it's racism, it's poverty, it's lack of education, it's this, it's that. All of that was there when I was growing up, and worse. I mean, we had all those toxic attitudes, and people weren't getting shot. So I came to the conclusion, which I still hold, that one of the things that would responsible communities should do would be to limit access for people, especially children, and unauthorized people. And you can, understand who that would be, someone who's extremely depressed, so many of these murders occur in acts of moments of despair, of such deep despair. And so we thought that would be a responsible thing to do.
Sure. I mean, the coalition forms with the goal of getting guns off the street, tried a number of things, including legislation,
That's right.
which would restrict the sale of guns, and also gun givebacks and other kind of projects that could be done through churches. Tell us about the legislation, because you had some success.
Correct. Oh, we had this wonderful coalition of ministers, and Sylvia Kirchhoff was mayor then, and she was just wonderful. And Mel Williams of Watt Street Baptist Church, who's my hero and mentor, was very much present in that. And so we did have success, and we were able to pass local legislation that really shouldn't, that guns were not, it was not appropriate to have the presence of guns at funerals or baseball or football or basketball games, city parks where my children were playing. And I can't remember the year, but there was soon thereafter a response in the North Carolina General Assembly that preempted every municipality, city, county, everyone, all local government from having any kind of legislation about guns. And it wasn't just about gun ownership. It was about manufacture, distribution, possession,
It was an unusual preemption in that it didn't preempt a particular law. It preempted laws from that day forward. The NRA very successful in getting that legislation here and in other states.
That's right. Preemption usually replaces a law.
Right.
No replacement.
It was just preempting before the law was even passed in some cases. So now you're faced with this. When did the change occur for you? What happened to bring you to the point that this kind of work wasn't what it was all about?
Well, I continued to serve on committees and seek a solution that was really kind of outside my life and the life of those who were most affected, as you said earlier. And the change came, there was many points. One of, I think, the most important one was when I was in the midst of this and my son said the prayer, "Dear Lord, make my soul grow." And I was just flabbergasted. And it opened my heart and my life, my soul. And I realized my soul's not growing. I mean, you can't love an institution and an institution can't love you. And so through 14 years ago, we began the vigils. And so with that sort of opening that my beloved Tom gave me, and with the vigils and meeting the families and loving them, I mean, just unbelievable. They were my ministers. And it began to change. And so I would be in meetings and what would be passed, and I knew what would get passed, if anything got passed, would be more punishment. And it was not what the families were seeking. And I just realized that I had thought right over the heads of the people I cared about. And that really transformation occurs when you are in relationship and that you allow yourself to suffer.
We'll talk about those relationships, how they grew and how they developed into the book, Living Without Enemies, when our conversation continues with Marcia Owen. We'll introduce Sam Wells as well, the Dean of Duke University Chapel, and putting the coalition's community engagement into a broader theological context. That conversation continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio Broadcast Service at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today, talking about a different approach to social activism. The Religious Coalition for Nonviolent Durham tries to be a presence in those Bull City neighborhoods where violence and poverty are most prevalent. That means recognizing and mourning the loss of life, helping convicted criminals re-enter society, and expanding communities beyond the barriers of race, class, and geography. The Coalition's Executive Director, Marcia Owen, is with me in the studio, and I want to pick up on a little bit of what we talked about before the break. So you had this change of heart, change of mind about how to be. You said you were talking over the people you wanted to help and bringing them in. Has that changed things? What does it mean to work with people in that community when you don't live in that community? I mean, seriously, how do you do that?
Right. Well, it is my community. For one thing, I feel like I live all over Durham, quite frankly. But with the vigils, I'd like to go kind of back to that. So how do we get here? What I realized is that if we don't stop and recognize the dignity and worth of the people that we have lost, if we don't give ourselves the opportunity, the formal opportunity as an individual to mourn together, very different than crying at home alone, then we haven't done what is the most important thing to do, that there should be no talk of policy. There should be no talk of response until we have lamented and we have affirmed the dignity and worth that each one of us possess, the sacredness of each one of us. And so that's how it all happened, really, is just that practice of remembering not what we are, but who we are as children of God, as
when you're an activist and you're working for legislation, you're trying to get something changed. You have goals. You know how to measure them. We got the bill. Right. We lost the bill. Right. That sort of thing. Do you look for measurable goals in this, and what are they?
That's really – I just love – a spiritual life is one of paradox. That's all I can say. Over and over. It just astounds me how paradoxical it is. No measurable results. I learned that from a wonderful group of people at McMahon United Methodist Church. We were discussing that very thing. What is, how do we measure our success? And one of the members said, to be faithful. And I realized, that's it. You know, that's, there you have it. And the same with the vigils. When I have spoken about them in various venues, people are often very angry. that we do them. They have, you know, very, very perturbed that we would do something as senseless in a way as have a vigil. The person's dead is what they often say. They're dead. What can you do? And I really do believe in my soul that from the point of love, from the point of what will exist forever, is that there is really no distinction between prevention and intervention and what maybe I would call postvention, that all acts of love, all moments when you open your heart to another in service, in seeking understanding, that's enough, that's measurable result enough, that love exists in relationship and it exists in eternity, that we are living in an infinite reality. And to have measurable results, for me, I could just hear my ego screaming, not my heart, but my head. And it brings me back to who I am and what I have to give. I don't have many material gifts, but I think we all have infinite love to give.
And those, of course, are deeply held spiritual convictions rooted in theological concepts, whether it grew from that in your case or not, it is true. And so I want to bring into this conversation now Sam Wells, who is the dean of Duke University Chapel. Samuel Wells has written a number of books on moral theology. The latest is the one he co-authored with Marcia. It's called Living Without Enemies, Being Present in the Midst of Violence. Sam Wells, welcome back to The State of Things.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
We'll get to the book in a moment, but I first want to talk about your relationship with the Coalition. You first got here from Durham, England, 6 years ago as a preacher and scholar. Then you met Marcia very early on. Give us your sense of what you saw. How did you see your mission, first of all, coming to Duke Chapel? And was there any of kinship you felt with Marcia once you saw what she was doing?
Well, my first reaction, I think, when I came, you know, Duke Chapel, we're very fortunate. We have a very large congregation, 1,000 or so people come on a semester Sunday from all different sort of backgrounds, university and elsewhere. And it struck me, it's the first time I'd lived in the American South, and the church in the American South has all the things the church in England thinks it lacks. That's numbers, money, and social influence. But the painful realization that came to me very quickly was that the kingdom of God wasn't really necessarily any closer because of those things. So quite quickly, as well as trying to develop my work in the church, I was really asking questions about the kingdom of God. Where is Jesus hanging out? It's not necessarily in the churches.
I want to stop you there just to get you to clarify this. The kingdom of God, what do you mean by that? That's something that's precisely in the heavens, isn't it?
Yeah, my understanding is that God intended the church, but that God doesn't only act through the church. And so if you like, sometimes you can get an experience where God is very present, where the Holy Spirit is very active, and you think, hey, this is what life is really all about. This is what it was all supposed to be. And that's what I call the kingdom of God, when those moments happen, little glimpses of heaven, if you like. And so one of the campus ministers at Duke, Sherry Henry, let me know in the summer of 2005, I think it was August, she was taking a few of her students to a vigil. I had no idea what she was talking about. It was late in the afternoon, and I thought, well, can I come too? I mean, this sounds curious. I haven't experienced something like this before. I was very aware of the issues of gun violence. Obviously, coming new to America, I wasn't used to it on the same level in Europe. But I thought, well, I'll go along. And when I went, I felt all the things that Marcia's been just describing. That sort of emptiness was the first thing. You know, most people here didn't know the victim. What are we doing here? How does this make a difference? And then I had this wonderful sensation when I was in this group, and there must have been about 18 or so people there, that this is beautiful. It's not making it better, but it's beautiful. And for a long time, I've had this conviction. I always thought I'd write on my gravestone, not that I would be doing the writing, but I'd ask someone, I'd leave a message somewhere for someone to write on my gravestone, if it can't be happy, make it beautiful. And that's been a sort of personal motto for most of my adult life. And I was in that circle, and I thought, well, this is about as close to this motto as I've ever come. And then over comes this woman who wants to hug me. And, you know, and as I say in the book, we hugged before we ever spoke. And that's Marcia. And people have had a chance to hear Marcia already, and they can see how you can't say no when Marcia wants to hug you. And so, as I say, as we just say in the book, I felt what I was discovering was these three responses to the emptiness and the horror of death, and the three responses are silence, touch, and words. That you start with the silence; there is nothing to say, and you face the emptiness of that, and all you've got is each other, just showing up. As they say, you know, most of life is just showing up, and these people had shown up, and so they'd filled that emptiness of the silence with their bodily presence, and their mutual recognition that there is nothing we can do, there is nothing we can say, and yet we're here anyway. There's a kind of stubbornness about that, and then people start to touch each other. They hand round mementos of the deceased. They pass around a poem that he once wrote to his mother. They hand round a photograph of him or something like that. And then they light a candle, or, you know, there are things you actually can do to fill this void, this terrible void, and then people want to hug each other at the end because they feel they've experienced something profound together. They don't have a language for it. They don't know what to call it. They don't know what's happened, but they know that something's happened. And what's happened is that they've together filled the emptiness of loss and death. And then only at that stage do the words start to count. You know, because as you know yourself, when you rush into somebody who's experienced tragedy with words of reassurance, you miss the mark 99 times out of 100. You can't possibly know. You only earn the right to use words and to find words to say once you've been through that silence and touch together.
You have said that you were worried. You say in the book that you were a little bit worried about this vigil when you went. The fact that it could have been before you went, that it could have been done badly. That it might be insensitive.
Sure. I mean, we all know the expression "do-gooders."
Yeah.
You know, and do-gooders, that's a pejorative expression for people we think want to make a difference, want to make things better, but haven't really got a clue about the sensitivities of what are the dynamics of the relationships involved. And obviously there's a concern there that this is about do-gooders. But to put it a different way, these are people who've got the courage when they don't know what to do, when they don't know what to say, and there's an experience of profound suffering. They don't close their eyes. They don't walk away from it. They walk towards it, and they walk into it, but they walk into it with empty hands. Mm. They don't say, oh, well, I've done this course, and so I know what the stages of grief are. They don't walk in and say, well, I've got this bit of legislation. Can you sign a petition? And, you know, they face the humiliation of saying, there's nothing I can do to make this better. But that's not a reason why I'm going to avoid your gaze. That's not a reason why I'm going to avoid you, because I might make you cry or I might experience your grief. I'm going to be here. And I'm gonna sit here with you till you find what you want to see.
Is that perhaps the first stage of this bond, this humiliation that you feel at your emptiness, your pure futility? I can't do anything for you, and perhaps the humiliation and the futility of a parent who couldn't save a child, or anyone who's lost a loved one and couldn't make it stop.
Well, we want to feel there's something that we can do. You know, if you imagine your classic Victorian, your Dickens novel or something, your dramatized novel. You've got a doctor in a big black coat there, and the classic scene is always when the doctor says, "I'm afraid there's nothing we can do," and that's an ending. Whereas in fact, for this kind of ministry, it's the beginning. There's nothing I can do. I have no professional skills. I can't say I went to law school and I know how to write something. I can't say I went to medical school and I've got a bit of medication. I've got no panacea. I've got nothing that can take this away. And most of us, when we don't have, especially professionally trained people, we've formed our lives in such a way that we want to be able to give the solution. And if we can't give the solution, then we avoid any situation that might embarrass us. So this is an emptying out, is a humiliation to say, I have got nothing that is going to make this better. But that doesn't mean I'm going to run away. And that's a huge change of heart. And most of the people like yourself who I've come to know, who've engaged in reentry teams and have come along to vigils, maybe not very often, but the really challenging thing, and I've taken students to these vigils as well, is to be there when you've got nothing you've got in your pocket to make it better and still to stay there That's a really challenging thing for most of us.
We're going to get to the question of sort of what impact that has, but I want to talk about the architecture that you create in this book, a kind of theological structure around which to hang these ideas. And you talk about four different models of engagement. Tell us about those and where this fits.
Well, if you imagine an old-fashioned window with a cross and four panes, it's easiest to imagine it like that. So in the top left, you've got the notion of working for. That's the professional model. We equip ourselves with all these skills, and as I've been saying, we arrive with solutions. That's what most people who go to graduate school are preparing themselves to do. A different model is called working with. That's more like community organizing, where you don't assume that you've got the answer, but you've got a lot of skills, and you come into the conversation. You're not necessarily chairing the meeting, but you're assuming that the people who are in trouble, if you like, have need to be part of their own solution. A third model I call being with, if you like, the bottom left window, is where you don't assume that you've got any skills, and also you don't assume that the other people are the people in trouble. You say, actually, I'm in trouble. I'm in trouble because I don't know how to make friendships. I'm in trouble because I don't know what to say in the face of these things. I'm in trouble because I actually have a poverty of spirit inside myself, and I've gone to all these professional trainings to avoid me having to face that reality. And then the fourth model is being for. Being for, in a sense, lacks the activity of the working with and working for, and it also lacks the withness of being with. So the book is really commending the work of the coalition as a wonderful example of being with.
Being with, and not necessarily, as you say, this top-down being for and working for, all of which can be part of the solution, but there's a centerpiece. And
well, the society, I wouldn't be promoting being with if I felt there was any danger that the whole world was going to be converted to the notion of being with. Our whole society is structured. The people we reward in society, the people with the big salaries, those are all working for people. That's the way our whole society is set up. But we've got some major issues in our society that actually working for doesn't touch, and it possibly even makes worse. And those are really fundamentally issues of isolation. Being with is fundamentally about overcoming isolation. And if you think, I mean, when I was a kid, I first started to learn athletic sports. You know, I wanted to be the pitcher. I mean, you know, this was England. We didn't have pitchers. But, you know, I wanted to be the person at the center. I wanted to be in the action. Most people do. And the thing about working for things is that they seem like they're in the center of the action, but they're not really. If you're a physician, you're making someone better to return them, if you like, into the game. If you're an attorney, you're sorting out someone's legal trouble so they can return to regular life. But what is the heart of regular life? my suggestion is the heart of regular life is making real connections with other people and with yourself. And that's what being with is about. So why do these other these peripheral things, which are all working for things, which are all about getting people back into the action, why not be in the middle of the action? And that's what being with is about.
It strikes me, though, that this can be difficult and sensitive. So, Marcia, I wonder what it is you say when you call a stranger who has been, whose family member has died, and you say you'd like to organize this vigil. What do you say?
Well, I say that I'm very sorry and that I share your grief, that your son or daughter was my sister and brother, and that your loss is also the loss of this community, and that I recognize that we have lost an irreplaceable person. And so I call with great humility, and really nothing more.
What kind of responses have you got? Because in the book, you talk about the fact that people really don't always accept this, and you can understand that.
Yes, absolutely. And most families do, though. We're there to honor that person. And I think that people realize, I certainly have in my life, that people can carry your load, that the kindness and the care of others matters. It helps.
Have you seen examples of the way this has helped, the way this has worked to change people, families who have been victims of crime, and also, we'll start there, and then we'll talk about the other people who go.
Well, I don't want to speak for the families necessarily, but it sure has changed me. I think that the friendships that I have been graced with, it's invaluable. It's an unreasonable joy. Isn't that paradoxical?
Right. Well, but I know, too, that you have examples of people who were resistant at first and said they didn't want any part of this. This is too much. And who are you? And go away. Leave me alone. They became part. And as a result of the friendship and the relationships they developed, also got help, got some counseling, and felt connected to a community that then allowed them to get beyond the grief.
Yes, I think it's important. And in commenting what Sam said on the four pains that we're able to be with because we have those other three, thankfully. So a family, if it's not the time, and I completely submit to their wishes, that if we didn't have those other three, that we would, that it would be very, very frustrating, and I bet we'd go make them. So we're able to work with wonderful, wonderful people. The North Carolina Child Response Initiative from the Duke Child and Family Health. So they have traumatic grief counselors and therapists.
I'm going to take a break right here,
sure.
And we're going to come back. My guest this hour, Marcia Owen, Executive Director of the Religious Coalition for Nonviolent Durham. Samuel Wells is with us, the Dean of Duke Chapel, and our conversation will continue on the state of things. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking this hour about new models of engagement with underprivileged communities. My guest, Marcia Owen, Executive Director of the Religious Coalition for Nonviolent Durham. Sam Wells, Dean of Duke Chapel. Together, they've written a book called Living Without Enemies, Being Present in the Midst of Violence. And Marcia, just before the break, you were talking about your experience in all of this and the fact that it has changed you. There's a critique out there as well that despite your best intentions to transcend this do-gooder model and going into communities, trying to be with, that it's just another form of the same thing, that you come away spiritually enriched, but the community is still left with violence, lots of handguns, and nothing much changes, but you feel better about yourself.
Wow.
How would you respond to that critique?
Well, I think that you should interview the people, the families. I can only say that the friendships that I've been given, you know, that with moms and dads of, I mean, I think that I'll go back to what I said before, which is I think love exists in relationship, and I can't speak for them, but I would suspect that they too have enjoyed the love that we share.
Sam?
I think the question is a classic example of a being for approach to life, which is let's get all our attitudes correct, let's read all the right newspapers, listen to the right radio programs, including this one, I hope, and make sure we never use language that's inappropriate of any kind to any kind of minority group or anything, but we never actually do anything because we, you know, we're afraid to take the risk of actually getting something wrong. But of course, that's the only way we learn, is to get something wrong. Being with approach says, okay, so you're saying this is really about me. Well, actually, I'm the one in need. You see, the working for approach says, oh, you're in need, and evaluates how much I've translated my bounty into your neediness. Being with says, actually, yeah, I'm in need. And you, despite the fact that you've lost a loved one in a violent way, you've got a lot to teach me. You know, that what I constantly go back to is the Good Samaritan parable in Luke's Gospel in the New Testament. That you know, the working for approach assumes that we're the Samaritan. We've got these goods just to get people out of the gutter. Being with us assumes that we're the man by the side of the road. We're the one in need. And here along comes this person that, like Jews with Samaritans, we wouldn't normally mix with, we wouldn't want to talk to, we wouldn't eat with, we wouldn't touch. And they've actually got the answer to all our problems. So if someone says, this is actually, really, you're getting more out of this than anyone else, I would say, guilty. Yeah, I am. What problem do you have with that?
And it seems to me that with that, there's a kind of coalition building that could be much more powerful than the sort of working for a model, the idea that people are really getting together, taking personally some of the problems that they thought, perhaps, were other people's problems. Gun violence doesn't happen in my neighborhood, so it's their problem.
Well, that's the crucial thing. I mean, as Marcia said a moment ago when she said about what she actually says to families, I mean, I find that so moving when she picks up the phone and she says, this isn't just your loss. This is a loss for all of us. In other words, I'm in pain here too. This is a loss for me. But actually to have the imagination to realize that is a loss for me, that's the journey to make, to realize that I've lost something.
Social imagination, you talk about that in the book, and the fact that in some ways the models we have damaged social imagination, that we, for one, can fall into despair pretty quickly when even the working for model doesn't seem to change things very much. And when that same model makes it easy for us not to take personally all of the crime and all of the suffering that we see around us. So what changes? So if we imagine a world in which we are truly brothers and sisters and in which that was my brother who was killed on the street, will that change the situation, or is that something we don't need to expect?
Well, we're facing a very polarized social and political situation in this country right now. We have half of us think the market is the answer to all our problems. Half of us think the state is the answer to all our problems. And the trouble is neither of those are the answer to all our problems. In fact, they're both kinds of forms of technology. I have this phrase about technology. Technology is trying to make a better world without us needing to become better people. And the market can become a kind of technology. We think if we just apply these certain rules that come from 18th century economics, you know, then everything will be fine. But we know that's not true, because people get burnt, they get hurt, they get thrown off the wagon. And then the market has no way of addressing. We all know that. But if we just rely on the market, we have no way of reaching those people or making a relationship with those people. Likewise, the state, the model of the state assumes you can make laws, you can make agencies, you can make official institutional ways in which you deal with every problem. But that still leaves people isolated. It still gives people permission. I mean, that's what's happened in Europe. You see, you don't make relationships with people because you feel the state should deal with that problem. But the real heart of things is isolation from one another. And the irony is that both the market and the state replicate that isolation from one another. And that's what being with is fundamentally about, is saying, I'm not going to walk away from you when you get in difficulty. In fact, difficulty is when it really gets interesting. I'm going to walk towards you. I'm going to be drawn towards the places of greatest pain and of greatest suffering, because that's where I believe God shows up most regularly. And so that's the change, I think. It's obviously an abstract picture for a grand social change, but it's a change in each of our hearts that says we actually can't find a piece of technology, a wonderful program, an amazing book, a marvelous new business, a change in the economy. There is going to be no technique. There's going to be no piece of technology, because the real problem is our isolation from one another.
I can hear critics, though, say that this feeds into a kind of political philosophy that says, yeah, so let's keep the state out of it. This is not about helping and programs and all of that. Just pull yourself up by your bootstraps and leave people to their own, and they'll work their way out of that problem.
But that's another way of saying we can leave people alone. This is all about saying we cannot leave people alone. To me, the heart of the gospel is God is with us. God never leaves us alone, regardless of how awful us its life circumstances are. We know that God will never leave us alone. And the way to follow that gospel is not to leave people alone. And again, the working for model assumes the only reason you should be in somebody else's life if you've got the answer to their problems. You know their problems before they know what their problems are. You see them only as a problem. Whereas being with sees that this person is a gift to me. I'm missing out on that gift if I don't make myself present to them. I don't have to come with anything in my hands. I don't have an answer to their problems. I don't know what their problems are. It's for them to define anyway. And I'm not just a whole bunch of answers coming out of all of my pockets waiting to be visited upon somebody. I'm the one in need.
Marcia, this seems like such a difficult sell. How did things change for you when you began to recruit people, talk with people about becoming part of this ministry? It was one thing to say, let's get the petitions out there, let's get the legislation changed. How did things change for you when you began to recruit and talk with other people about joining you when it was, go to a place that you've never been, talk to someone you've never met at a murder scene and feel helpless and perhaps a little endangered? How is that different for you?
Well, I think that it was, I keep, glorious keeps coming up, that I realized what faith was, and to be in the presence of other people who were willing to say that all we're going to do is show up, know nothing, and expect healing. A woman who was at a vigil said that to me after the vigil, that this is what it is. And it was absolutely right to show up, know nothing, and expect healing. So I really didn't do much. I just opened the invitation up with the help, again, of the Herald Sun, who was so nice about just always putting our notices. And Durham Congregations in Action, God bless them all. And they began it. It was the executive director of David Weiner, a member of Judea Reform, who began the vigil. So let's get that story straight. He gave the task to me later after he had begun it. So I think that I had that same attitude with people, my friends and faithful folks of goodness in Durham, to, I don't need to know anything either. Yeah. Offer, invite, because I think hospitality is the other thing that I've learned from the coalition, is so much the heart of God, to invite people into your life, and that you don't have to have the house clean. That was a hard one that I've learned very well. You don't have to be prepared to love.
But we do have to be prepared to be open to this sort of thing.
That's exactly right.
And humility is hard to come by. And we've come to appreciate so much and internalize the differences, we don't even notice them. And there's an example in the book about your outrage, really, at the way the news was treating homicides in poor neighborhoods, relegating them to the third or fourth page, if that. And you talk to the editor of the newspaper. Tell us that story.
Oh, it's a wonderful story. We had every fourth Thursday of the month, we have a luncheon where we invite the community to come together as peacemakers and, you know, share concerns and opportunities and gifts. So we were having one of these fourth Thursday meetings at Covenant Presbyterian Church, and we invited the editor of the Herald Sun, and we just said, what does this communicate, that you are reporting these deaths so deep into the paper, like they don't really matter? And he was wonderful. It was wonderful that he was there, and it was wonderful that he said, well, we're just doing our job, you know. And I looked at him and I said, well, sir, if my son, and I'm a white woman, was shot and killed, you would put it on the third page of the Metro section? And he went, oh, no. And we were speechless. You know, we all just, you know, it was mainly these fabulous, ministers, primarily, you know, downtown churches, and who are very in the proximity to all of this and got it. Everybody got it. And we just looked at him and he went, oh, I get it. You know, and he changed his policy.
Yeah.
And he sought to begin, and because what we need in this community is information, that journalism is the paper, it's extraordinarily important, and we need to report what happens in our community from a prevention perspective. You know, what happened here? And what so often happens is that the victim is being characterized without
overtly
really,
or subtly.
Without. And with the help, and they're gone.
But Sam, I want to ask you another question, and this is a critique that can come up often in this case, and that is that this is all framed in religious terms. If you're not religious, is there any place for you in this model?
Well, again, it's not a question I can answer as a person of faith myself, but I mean, I think of a good friend who's a palliative care doctor who shares almost all the values we've been talking about today. He's not a person who's a theist. What's special about him is, as I was saying earlier, you know, when he stands before a patient and says, there's nothing I can do for you, and note the word for there, you know, there's nothing I can do for you. That's where the story begins for him rather than where the story ends. The conventional picture is that's a point where the doctor leaves the room and maybe the pastor comes in or the family or who else, you know, because it's all slush after that. Whereas for him, that's where the interesting part of being a doctor begins, is how a doctor can walk with a patient as they begin to envisage their own death. And again, the heart of that is not leaving people alone. And he would say the same thing, and not being frightened, because again, the conventional doctor model is you don't really meet people face to face. You meet them with the technology you have for making them better. Mm-hmm. And when you don't have any technology for making them better, you're kind of naked and embarrassed and you leave the room and you let the pastor or whoever deal with that. And he doesn't think like that. You know, he's a doctor who says, no, this is where it gets interesting. So I'm inspired by him. We don't necessarily share all our motivations, but we certainly share most modes of operation.
What about you, Marcia? How important is religion in all of this, and can you do this if you're not religious?
Oh, yes. I think over and over, I find people who are the most faithful who declare no faith. And that, yes, of course, it is in relationship, and it is that fearlessness and willingness to be present in another's life that doesn't have much to do with religion. For me as a person of faith, you know, it's my language. But I think that everyone, everyone's in the kingdom. And that's what I've learned is so much is that we do, in fact, relate to one another about what we perceive people to be and not who they really are and who I really am. And so no problem there. Everyone's in it, whether they like it or not.
Sam, I've only got a minute left, and of course this could be, because of the religious terms, somewhat difficult for people without religion. I think this is even more difficult for people who are religious and are Christian and who have practiced their faith in a different way, see the kingdom as above and not on earth. Can this be a manual for those social concerns, social justice committees in various congregations?
It's exactly written with them in mind. I think I talked about a piece of technology. People often have been brought up to see God as a piece of technology, that God is, you know, God gets us into heaven, you know, through Jesus dying on the cross and so on, that God gets us out of a hole that we might happen to be in if we pray and things, that God's a kind of device, whereas I see God as fundamentally being with us in all things. And that's a change of the theological view. And if you see God as fundamentally a piece of technology, you start to see yourself as one. Yeah. And you say, my job in other people's lives is to fix them. I don't see God's job in our lives as fundamentally to fix. It's to be with us whether things are fixed or not.
Thank both of you for being with us this hour. Deeply appreciated, Marcia. Sam, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Marcia Owen, Executive Director of the Religious Coalition for a Nonviolent Durham. For more information, you can go online to nonviolentdurham.org. Samuel Wells, Dean of Duke University Chapel. Their book is called Living Without Enemies. You can visit ivppress.com to learn more about that. You can go to stateofthings.org to learn more about us. And this is The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service, the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.